Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
There is no single residence in America that seems to fit the description of haunted house better than the Winchester Mansion in San Jose, California. And if there is a house that has a richer history, a more mysterious reputation, and a greater reputation for its connections to the spirit world, I can't think of it. There are scores of stories connected to this house. For generations, it's been billed as an enigma, a massive structure for which no accurate room count has ever been taken. Doors open to brick walls, they say, staircases lead to nowhere, hallways suddenly end, secret passages open to other parts of the building, all combining to create a madhouse of gigantic proportions. Who built the house? Well, that's a story most of us know. In 1862, Sarah Pardee married William Wirt Winchester, the son of a successful shirt maker who went on to found the Winchester Repeating Arms Company. Sarah and William's daughter died in infancy in 1866, and then William followed the little girl to the grave. In 1885, Sarah, now a wealthy widow, moved to the Santa Clara Valley, where she bought a farmhouse and began enlarging it. It grew massively, and by the time she died in 1922, it had countless rooms and sprawled in every direction. But why did she build such a huge house for herself? Well, if you've read pretty much any book about haunted houses, you probably know that too. Sarah created a labyrinth to trap the spirits who wanted to kill her, which is why she constructed hallways that came to a dead end, staircases that stopped at the ceiling, and rooms built inside of other rooms. The spirits, the stories say, were seeking revenge for their murders, which had been committed by Winchester Rifles, the company that Sarah now owned. It was a house, everyone agreed, that had been paid for by blood. Open to the public, the year after Sarah died, the house became famous, eventually earning a place in American culture as the inspiration for Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House and for the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland. Stephen King, who first read about the house in a Ripley's Believe It or Not comic when he was a boy, later turned it into Rose Red when he wrote the 2002 miniseries about a team of paranormal researchers who investigate a massive, sprawling maze of a house. The Winchester Mansion has earned a place of prominence among those who are fascinated with ghosts and haunted history. It is without question the Mount Everest of American haunted houses, a mansion that was literally designed by ghosts. Every account of the house clearly states that Sarah Winchester visited her séance room in the mansion each night, where she received the design plans from the spirit world, which allowed her to continue building her mansion 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We know all these stories, but the real question is, do we know the truth? The true story of the Winchester Mansion and Sarah Winchester herself isn't nearly as cut and dried as the legend of the house claims that it is. If you think you've heard the real story of this famous house, then you might be surprised by this episode. Because when it comes to the Winchester Mansion, nothing is as it seems. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to Season 8, Home, which is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and produced and co-hosted by Cody Back. This season, we're on a cross-country trip in search of America's murder houses, relics of time and crime gone by. We're going behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places where murder and violence have left lingering ghosts behind. In this episode, we're visiting one of the most famous haunted houses in America, one that was not only designed by ghosts, but apparently is teeming with them today. But how much of what we know about this mysterious mansion is truth, and how much is fiction? Well, hold on, because you're about to find out. This is episode 20 of the season, the true story of the Winchester Mansion. The legend of the house, which has been told so many times over the years that most people take the truth of it for granted, begins with the death of Sarah Winchester's daughter and husband. When William died from tuberculosis, Sarah inherited his large estate, as well as his share of the Winchester Repeating Arms Company, which provided her with an income of about $1,000 per day. But this newfound wealth did little to ease her pain. Believing her family might be cursed, Sarah took the advice of a friend and went to see a spirit medium by the name of Adam Koons. During a seance, Koons told her that her family was being haunted by the ghosts of all those killed by Winchester rifles, particularly the Native Americans that had been slain. The only way to keep them at bay was to sell their property and head toward the setting sun. The spirit of her husband would guide her, and when she found her new home in the West, she would recognize it. And then she would begin building a house that was never to be finished, an endless work in progress. And as long as she continued building, she would live. If she stopped, the medium told her, she would die. Shortly after the seance, Sarah sold her home and, with a vast fortune at her disposal, moved west to California. She believed she was being guided by the hand of her dead husband and didn't stop traveling until she reached the Santa Clara Valley. Here she found an 8-room farmhouse under construction, and she bought it, along with the 162 acres that surrounded it. She hired a large crew of local workers and craftsmen, and for the next 36 years, they built and rebuilt, altered and changed, and constructed and demolished one section of the house after another. She kept 22 carpenters working nonstop. They worked year-round, 24 hours a day. The sounds of hammering and sawing were heard throughout the day and night. The story of a house that remained under endless construction as a way to stay alive creates the idea of a woman whose superstition and gullibility led her to build a house that makes no sense. Each morning, it was said, Sarah met with the foreman on the project and they went over her hand-sketched plans for the day's work. The plans were the result of the nighttime seances that were conducted in the blue room in the center of the house, where benign spirits would instruct her on how to design the mansion and stay safe from the evil spirits that wanted to kill her. As the days, weeks, and months passed, the house continued to grow. Rooms were added to rooms and then turned into entire wings. Doors were joined to windows, levels turned into towers and peaks, and the place eventually grew to a height of 7 stories. Inside the house, 3 elevators were installed, as were 47 fireplaces. Sarah was apparently intrigued by the number 13, and this has become a well-established aspect of her life. There are 13 bedrooms, 13 bathrooms, 13 panes of glass in some windows, and 13 windows in certain rooms. The construction also included the house's signature features, like the staircase that ascends half a flight, makes a 90-degree turn to the left, and then ends directly at a wall, a trick to throw off ghosts who might be pursuing Sarah. But of course, those weren't the only strange additions made to the house. There were other staircases that led nowhere, closets that opened to blank walls, trap doors, hallways that doubled back on themselves, doors that opened to steep drops to the lawn below, and dozens of other oddities that created a labyrinth-like puzzle of traps and detours that were meant to confuse the ghosts haunting Sarah. It was a private maze that only she understood and only she knew, where she could feel safe from the malevolent spirits. In addition to trying to confuse the vengeful spirits killed by Winchester rifles, Sarah also made an effort to appease the friendly ones. The house was richly furnished and decorated with gold and silver chandeliers, art glass windows, Belgian crystal, art-molded bronze bathtubs, exquisite marble, and custom-made Tiffany glass. Sarah became reclusive after enduring complaints from the community for years. The stories the workmen carried home about their eccentric employer raised many eyebrows, which didn't help the gossip. So Sarah had her groundskeepers plant large bushes along the property line, hoping to block the stares of the curious. Whenever she went into town, she wore a black veil over her face. Because she never called on her neighbors, she didn't expect people to call on her. In fact, she didn't want anyone, except for the workmen, to enter her home. Any curiosity seeker or even well-meaning local who approached the house was quickly turned away by one of the servants. Eventually, the front door was ordered locked and boarded up and was never used again. And Sarah didn't discriminate when it came to turning away visitors, whether they were famous or not. One such caller was President Theodore Roosevelt, a Winchester rifle and hunting enthusiast. He came to the house one day, and while his entourage was directed to the rear carriage house that was designed so that Sarah's horse and buggy could secretly enter the house, it's unknown if he ever spoke with Sarah. Some visitors were not even that lucky. Christian Science founder Mary Baker Eddy was turned away at the gate. Expansion on the house continued. The number of rooms increased. Chimneys were installed all over the place, although strangely, they served no purpose. Some believe that perhaps they were added because old stories say that ghosts like to appear and disappear through them. On September 4th, 1922, after a session with the spirits in the seance room, Sarah went to her bedroom for the night. At some point in the early morning hours, she died in her sleep at the age of 83. She left all her possessions to her niece, who had been handling most of Sarah's business affairs for some time. In her will, Sarah had an unusual request. She asked that all subsequent owners of the house allow the ghosts to be welcomed there and tell everyone the story of why the house had been built. And to this day, her final wishes have been carried out, and thousands of visitors still pass through the doors of the amazing mystery house that was built for the dead. As compelling as the story we all know about the Winchester Mansion is, there are, let's just say, a few problems with it. It's been frequently cited that the house is filled with, quote, staircases that go nowhere, but there's really only one, and it's the result of the house losing an upper floor during the great San Francisco earthquake of 1906. Sarah never rebuilt that floor. Her fascination with the number 13 is a concoction. It was pure happenstance a few times, and it was then cooked up for publicity. There's no evidence that Sarah ever visited a medium or believed her family was cursed. The story of the ghosts of victims of Winchester rifles was a later invention. In addition to the mansion, Sarah owned several other large but average homes, and most of her later years were spent in her house in Atherton, some miles away, and she spent very few of her last 17 years at the Winchester Mansion, which, by the way, she called Yonda Villa, which is Spanish for house on flat land. The blue room in the center of the house where she supposedly conducted her seances each night at midnight, that was her gardener's bedroom. She got a reputation as a recluse because she shunned the public. She didn't want to go out because she was very self-conscious about how arthritis had disfigured her hands, and also because she was missing many teeth. This is why she wore a veil in public, to hide her mouth. She never considered her greatest legacy to be the house, but the vast amounts of money she gave to research and treat tuberculosis, the illness that had killed her husband. Even knowing all that, though, some questions do remain. If the legend of the Winchester Mansion is mostly, if not entirely, untrue, then what is the real story? Why is this house so large? Why did she keep building, and why doesn't it make sense? And why did someone make up a story about vengeful ghosts, a story we've all embraced for so long, and how did it manage to cause the true story of the house to be completely forgotten? Sarah Lockwood Pardee was born in New Haven, Connecticut in 1839 to an upper middle class family. She was the third youngest of six children, all but one of them girls. And she grew up in the industrial towns of the region. Sarah's father, Leonard, was a woodworker who had established himself as an expert craftsman of the ornamental flourishes that were a major part of the architecture of the Victorian age. Among those who had also achieved great things during this time of American industrialism was the party's neighbor, Oliver Winchester. He had arrived in New Haven in 1845, almost penniless, but determined to make a name for himself. With his combination of business sense and knowledge of mechanics, he had reversed his fortunes within a decade. Using an innovative design for the production of men's shirts, he and his business partner, John Davies, founded the Winchester and Davies Shirt Manufacturing Company, which soon dominated the industry. Next door, Leonard Pardee was also on his way to major business success, but he had a small problem. He had too many daughters. In those days, they were considered a financial liability, especially since he'd given them all a good education at the finest schools. Now, it was time to marry them off and let them be somebody else's problem. Well, Sarah became the second of the sisters to reach the altar. She married her neighbor's son, William Wirt Winchester, in 1862. It was a simple ceremony, much simpler than it should have been for two wealthy families, but there was a war going on, and it was decided that it was not the time for extravagance. During the week that William and Sarah were married, there were battles fought in Missouri, Louisiana, and Virginia. It had only been a year since the Battle of Bull Run, but already death had reached almost every corner of both the North and South. William and Sarah's families mostly stayed out of the war. They were rich enough to spend the $300 for a deferment that allowed someone else to enlist in their place. Sarah's brother had been at the first Battle of Bull Run, but chose not to re-enlist after his initial three-month service was up. But Oliver Winchester wanted to be more involved in the war. In 1857, he had bought the failing Volcanic Repeating Arms Company from Horace Smith and Daniel Wesson, two inventors who had come up with a promising but complicated reloading process for rifles. And if those names sound familiar, you can rest assured Smith and Wesson later founded another gun company that had a lot more success. Well, Oliver knew that a repeating rifle, one that could be reloaded in a matter of seconds instead of a minute or more, could change the war for good. He was convinced the U.S. Army would buy them if they could be produced. So he took one of his most valued mechanics from his shirt factory, Benjamin Henry, and worked with him to improve on Smith & Wesson's idea. Well, despite its obvious advantages, the resulting Winchester repeating rifle didn't make much of an impact on the Civil War. A few individual soldiers purchased them, but the Army never really adopted them. And by the end of the war, repeating rifles only made up 1% of the weapons used in battle. Probably for this reason, William saw his father's venture into guns as an interesting side project, but that was about it. The family's real fortune was still in shirts. By then, William was the company secretary, and he and Sarah had built themselves a comfortable life. And things got even better on June 15, 1866, when Sarah gave birth to a daughter, whom they named Annie, after William's sister, who had recently died in childbirth. There was nothing out of the ordinary about Annie's birth, but almost immediately, the little girl seemed to deteriorate before their eyes. She was diagnosed with a condition called marasmus, an illness that doesn't allow the body to process food. Normally, it's caused by severe malnutrition, but Annie wasn't lacking in food. Her body simply couldn't process it. She died on July 5th, only 40 days old. In the years that followed, William continued at Winchester and Davies, but his father's other business was rapidly changing. The repeating rifle had finally taken off, and the company was working quickly to meet demand. Oliver had managed to secure lucrative contracts with foreign countries, which allowed the company to thrive during a post-war depression. By 1869, with the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad, the rifle began to be marketed as the best weapon for frontier self-defense. And in time, the Winchester rifle would earn the nickname of the gun that won the West and became a symbol of America's westward expansion and the Indian Wars that followed. With the West becoming an important part of the company's fortunes, Oliver established offices in San Francisco, and in 1870 sent William and Sarah to the Bay Area to oversee their opening. But Sarah wouldn't stay there. Not yet. When stories tell of the deaths in Sarah Winchester's family, the ones that drove her to build her house in San Jose, they mostly mean the deaths of her infant daughter and her husband, as if these deaths happened close together. They didn't. In fact, they were 16 years apart. Annie died in 1866, but Sarah continued living in New Haven until the mid-1880s. She and William never had another child, but by all accounts, they lived happily together in the years that followed. Then in early 1880, Sarah's mother died, and in the winter of that same year, her father-in-law, Oliver, also died, followed by her husband less than a year later from tuberculosis. By the mid-1880s, Sarah found her immediate family was nearly gone. And that was when she moved to San Jose, but she was not guided there by her husband's ghost. Sarah and William had visited the area a decade before, and she'd found the climate and scenery quite pleasant, but that still wasn't the real reason. Sarah didn't go to California alone. She went there with two of her sisters and their families because her brother-in-law, Homer Sprague, had been appointed president of Mills College in Oakland in 1885. When Homer and Sarah's sister Antoinette moved to the Bay Area, both Sarah and another sister, Isabel Merriman, and her family all moved together to San Jose. Sarah, with her money and inheritance, planned to build a home to house all of them. Well, Sarah's initial plan was to enlarge the farmhouse she bought so it could comfortably fit her entire family. But Homer's time at Mills College ended almost before it began. And within a year, he and Nettie had moved to North Dakota for a different university job. Then Isabel and her family decided to move to San Francisco, leaving their daughter Marion behind with Sarah. Now it seemed her grand plan of building a great house for herself and her extended family was all for nothing. And yet, Sarah kept building. She initially hired two architects, but quickly fired them, preferring to do most of the work herself. Most of what we know about her building methods come from letters written to her sister-in-law, Hannah Jane Bennett. They are not the words of a madwoman haunted by spirits, but a woman experimenting with the construction and design of a house. She wrote, "I am constantly having to make an upheaval for some reason. For instance, my upper hall, which leads to the sleeping apartment, was rendered so unexpectedly dark by a little addition that after a number of people had missed their footing on the stairs, I decided that safety demanded something to be done. So over a year ago, I took out a wall and put in a skylight." No matter what someone might tell you, Sarah did not employ workers 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In letters, she noted that when she found the plaster she wanted wouldn't set correctly in the summer heat, she laid off the workers until cooler weather came. Another part of a letter reads, "Then I became rather worn and tired out and dismissed all the workmen to take such rest as I might through the winter." There was a back and forth to Sarah's construction. She would often be getting the place ready to entertain guests and family from New Haven who were accustomed to houses of a certain size, but then she continually postponed her invitations under the pretense that the house was never quite done. She often wrote that she wanted the house to get situated so that it wouldn't be an imposition on her friends when she invited them to visit her. Now, this was something she said after 10 years of construction. At some point, the constant construction seems to have become a pretense for keeping her family away. There's one I never thought of. Or was there more to it than that? Another way of looking at it is that at some point, the house stopped being about a place for her family to live and took on a life of its own. We're used to seeing Sarah Winchester as an eccentric woman who believed she was hounded by ghosts, not as an architectural pioneer. But she was. Sarah was a self-taught architect at a time when women architects simply didn't exist. She designed and built her home room by room, experimenting as she went, tearing out parts that didn't work. Giant, rambling mansions that took years to build were all the rage in that era, but only Sarah Winchester did it alone. But without any overall grand design, the Winchester Mansion seems to sprawl in a dozen different directions. And for many visitors, this is what makes the house so unsettling. It can feel endless, larger on the inside than the outside, a trope that's been used dozens of times in books and films since the house was constructed. But that's not why the house seemed so haunting to people at the turn of the last century. It was the mystery of what was happening inside. A mystery that the San Jose Daily News decided it would solve for its readers on March 29, 1895. In an uncredited article titled, "Strange Story, A Woman Who Thinks She'll Die When Her House Is Built," appeared within its pages. And once those pages made it into the hands of the public, the legend of Sarah Winchester, the widow in perpetual mourning, the superstitious nutcase whose wealth was wasted in a delusional quest to keep spirits away, truly began. The article begins by describing the house, and then it gets down to business. It reads, 10 years ago, the handsome residence was apparently ready for occupancy, but improvements and additions are constantly being made, for the reason, it is said, that the owner of the house believes that when it is entirely completed, she will die. This superstition has resulted in the construction of a maze of domes, turrets, cupolas, and towers, covering territory enough for a castle. The article then continues laying out the story that has come to be associated with Sarah Winchester, a story that has remained pretty much unchanged for more than a century. As fast as new rooms are finished and they are all made with the very latest and most modern of accessories, they are furnished with the utmost elegance and clothes to be used hardly at all. Mrs. Winchester and her niece live alone in the great residence, and its doors are closed to all but a few. The tap, tap, tapping of the carpenter's hammers never disturbs them in their many luxurious quarters, which are far removed from the sound as if it were somebody else's house that was being built. Now, why would someone create such a strange story about Sarah? Because not only did it paint an untrue picture of her home, but it contributed to the vicious rumors that soon began to spring up about her. 2 years earlier, in May 1893, the United States suffered its worst economic downturn in decades, one that would lead to a depression that would remain unrivaled until the 1930s. By 1895, unemployment had gone from 4% to 14%, and there had been more than 500 bank failures and more than 1,600 businesses that had closed down. It was a national nightmare, felt by everyone from coast to coast. Men were out of work, and women and children were hungry in every town, including San Jose. Sarah Winchester, a recluse, a woman with an odd house, someone who gave generously to charity but did so anonymously, who had no social circle to stand up for her, became an easy target. The whispered stories, the claims of insanity, her pathological mourning, all these things clung to Sarah because she seemed to be a gaudy reminder of the haves among all the have-nots in town. She was the wealthy 1%, and the people resented her for it. And they punished her with gossip and tall tales that turned into mythology. Defenders were few and far between, but 2 years later, an article appeared in the San Jose Evening News titled, "Only Gossip, No Truth in the Story of the Winchester Palace." It stated that the myth was the result of nothing but rumors. It disputed the stories of Mrs. Winchester being superstitious and believing she'd die when all the additions to the house were completed. It was, the article assured everyone, all nonsense. Now, the article did correct the legends that had grown up around Sarah, but oddly, some of the language in it served as a booster for investment in the Santa Clara Valley instead of a defense for Sarah. One section of the article read, "After a while, the lady might not want to have a nail driven about her place for fear that someone would run off to the newspaper with a cock and bull story. This would be the means of preventing the circulation of a large amount of money among builders and furnishers, and that is why we encourage people of wealth to locate in the Santa Clara Valley. We want industries developed, improvements to be made, and this valley beautified." The house, it seemed, was either the work of a rich, mentally unstable widow or a potential source for local jobs and investment. Either way, the story of the Winchester Mansion was, one way or another, about money. And it would continue to be, all the way up until today. After Sarah's death in 1922, the furnishings, Sarah's personal belongings, and all the surplus construction and decorative materials were removed from the house and sold. Her real estate assets were sold off one by one. All of her holdings, including houses and parcels of land she owned throughout the valley, out of all of them, only the Winchester Mansion itself was appraised as having zero value. Massive, sprawling, but beautiful, the house was worthless as real estate. It was too old, too strange, and useless for any buyer. At an auction of the property, there were no bidders. Only one man, John H. Brown, was interested. He didn't have the money to buy it, but he offered to lease it with an option to buy later. Brown was an amusement park showman. He'd started with a place called Crystal Beach Resort on Lake Erie, and there he'd invented one of the earliest roller coasters, a 10-mile-an-hour ride called the Backety Back, which in June 1910 killed a woman who had somehow been thrown from its slow-moving car. Well, Brown quickly moved his family to California, where he heard about the Winchester House and its unusual construction. Among the other attractions at Brown's Park had been a, quote, house of mystery, and it always had large crowds. So why not have a house of mystery bigger than anything you could find in an amusement park? Once a showman, always a showman. So Brown took the rumors of the Winchester House and added to them, building an entire mythology around the house and offering tours. By now, attitudes about America's westward expansion and manifest destiny had changed, as had the role of the Winchester rifle as the gun that won the West. Brown's tour now emphasized how the gun had killed scores of Native Americans, all of whom began haunting the widow who profited from the murderous weapon. It capitalized on Sarah's guilt and fears of supernatural revenge. Well, in reality, Sarah never expressed any guilt about the Winchester rifle. She didn't feel guilty about it, but Americans did. In the early 20th century, we looked at all that blood that had been spilled as we expanded west and decided, well, we didn't do it. The guns did. Well, among those who took a tour in the early years was Harry Houdini, who'd been spending much of his professional career at that point debunking mediums and disproving alleged supernatural happenings, but not at the Winchester House. After his visit, he didn't talk about Sarah being crazy or being duped by disreputable mediums. Instead, he repeated the story he'd been told on the tour and stated, quote, "Never was there such a marvelous place." Well, after Houdini gave his seal of approval to the tourist attraction that Sarah's mansion had become, business increased steadily. It grew even more when Robert L. Ripley featured the house in his syndicated newspaper column, Believe It or Not. Over the years, Sarah's former employees and friends made attempts to correct her story. Roy Leib, the business partner and son of her attorney, Samuel Leib, commented that Sarah was, quote, "as sane and clear-headed a woman as I've ever known, and she had a better grasp on business and financial affairs than most men." But words from her friends and many employees over the years didn't matter much. What seemed to matter more was a story that tapped into the social and cultural biases that were embodied by such an unsettling house. There was a bias against a woman living alone, cut off from society. There was a bias against her because she was very rich, and worse, as mentioned earlier, a bias against her for the fact that her fortune was made by the gun that won the West. With Sarah being the reclusive, wealthy woman associated with all that death, her home became the repository for all of America's guilt. She was remembered as someone she wasn't because Americans couldn't stand who they were. And that brings us to the ghosts. You know, the reason that thousands of people come to the house every year to see what the National Park Service, which operates the mansion, calls, quote, a large, odd dwelling with an unknown number of rooms. Since 1922, ghosts have been the main attraction at the Winchester Mansion. Perhaps not necessarily the ones that are flitting around the corners and floating down the hallways, but the ones who allegedly inspired the house to be built in the first place. But as we've just learned, the malevolent spirits who were trying to bring about the death of Sarah Winchester never existed at all, not in reality or even in her unhinged mind. They were the product of newspaper stories and an enterprising showman who turned the house into a tourist attraction. But this hasn't stopped dozens of people every year from claiming encounters with the house's otherworldly occupants, which leads me to ask, are these encounters merely imagination at work, or is the house truly haunted in some way? Well, the first ghostly happenings I can find date back to 1975, just 1 year after the house was placed on the National Register of Historic Places. Keith Kittle, who was the manager of the property at the time, invited a woman named Jean Borgen to visit. She was, at that time, a well-known psychic in the Bay Area, and Kittle thought that her visit would make a great publicity stunt for the Halloween season. He really didn't expect anything to come out of it, but hoped it would get some attention for the house. Well, shortly after arriving, the psychic naturally held a press conference, because why not? And when asked if there were ghosts in the house, she said that she had already seen one that morning. She also planned to hold a late-night seance that evening. Well, when the time came for the seance, she chose one of the bedrooms for its location. A table was set up, and another psychic, Joy Adams, sat down while Jean paced back and forth, trying to locate cold spots. She said that all questions for the spirit should be directed to Joy, who by this time had entered a trance state. One of the reporters spoke up and asked a question, apparently to Sarah Winchester, asking if she liked living in the house. A reply came from Joy's mouth, but the voice was that of an older woman. "Yes, I love it very much," she said, and began to laugh, explaining that she had just remembered some of the wonderful things that had happened while living in the house. Then she suddenly stopped laughing and said rather sharply, "The townspeople, they always talk about me." While Joy was talking, Jean was still walking around the room with her hands outstretched, hoping to encounter patches of cold air that would indicate the presence of spirits. She suddenly stopped and pointed at one of the reporters, who cried out that he felt hands pushing downward on his shoulders. The witnesses said that Jean's face suddenly aged before their eyes. Her hair appeared to turn gray and her face became etched with lines. In moments, she was unable to stand and appeared to be suffering a heart attack. It only lasted for a moment and then it was gone. When it was over, Jean stated that Sarah had been with them and that the discomfort she felt was because there were so many people in the room, because Sarah, after all, had closely guarded her privacy. In 1979, authors Richard Weiner and Nancy Osborne visited the Winchester House while doing research for a book about haunted places. They got permission to spend the night there from Keith Kittle. They originally planned to sleep in the Blue Room, which was not a seance room, as we already know, but one of the tour guides pointed them to another room. It was that bedroom, she said, that always frightened her. It was in this room in which Sarah was trapped during the 1906 earthquake, or so the story goes. The guide really couldn't pinpoint any particular thing about the room that bothered her, but she did say that sometimes the room would get very cold, but only in certain places. With that in mind, Weiner and Osborne decided to stay in that room. They hadn't been there very long when Weiner discovered an area of the room that was much colder than the surrounding atmosphere. Thinking it might be a draft, he searched for a place where the wind might be coming from, but couldn't find anything. He realized, too, that the cold air wasn't moving. It was perfectly still, he later claimed, that it was occupying an area that would roughly be the size of a human body. Even though they were convinced they were not alone in the room, they eventually went to sleep, but only for a little while. Just after 2 a.m., Nancy shook Weiner awake. "Wake up! Do you hear it?" It was the sound of piano music, even though there was no one in the house. A short time later, they heard footsteps walking down the hallway outside the bedroom. They looked to see who was there, but found nothing. Neither of them went back to sleep that night. Other odd events have also been reported over the years. A woman took the tour through the house one day and encountered a small gray-haired lady seated in the kitchen. At the end of the tour, she asked the guide about the lady dressed as Sarah Winchester and why this costume woman had not been pointed out during the tour. Well, the guide told her there had been no one dressed in costume that day. One night in 1979, several employees were buffing the floors on the second level of the house when they heard footsteps on the floor above them. They were the only ones in the building at the time. In January 1981, Alan Weitzel was locking up the house for the night, and as he walked the entire route of the tour, he shut down the lights as he went. He then locked the doors and walked out to the parking lot to get into his car. But when he turned and looked back at the house, all the lights on the third floor had been turned on again. A security guard once admitted the house has an inordinate number of false alarms, even though no one is ever found inside. Motion detectors are tripped even though no exterior alarms are triggered. It's as though someone is moving around inside the house, even though there's no way they could have gotten in. One summer afternoon, a tour guide was on the third floor when the door to the servants' call station somehow slammed shut. There was no wind that could have closed the door, and no one else was on the floor at the time. She could offer no explanation for what happened. One evening, a tour supervisor named Mike Bray was closing the house for the night. He was walking down an upstairs hallway when he heard the distinct sound of someone whispering his name. He searched all over for someone else in the house, but this occurred at the end of the day. The rest of the staff members had already left. And the list goes on and on. The stories have been recounted for more than 50 years now, with witnesses claiming to see the ghost of Sarah Winchester, hearing footsteps, reporting slamming doors, flickering lights, and anything else you might expect from a haunted house. But is this house really haunted? Are the stories just wishful thinking, a byproduct of the dozens of stories and rumors that were manufactured about the house to make it a profitable attraction? Or is there something more to them? Could they be some sort of residual energy from the past? Leftover phantoms of the workmen who labored on the house for years? Or has our deep belief in the fabricated stories of the Winchester Mansion somehow created a haunting? Has the continued repetition of spooky stories generated the spirits that lurk in the twisting corridors of the house, a tulpa-like ghost story of our own invention? Who's to say? I can only pass on what I believe to be the true story of the Winchester House and allow those who hear it to make up their own minds about what they want to believe. The only other thing that I can say for sure is that you'll never find a piece of American architecture like this house. And if the only thing that can preserve the brilliant work of a woman who went underappreciated in her lifetime, if that's for future generations to believe that her house is haunted, well, then I'm happy to say it's filled to the rafters with ghosts. Stay with us for the rest of the show and find out how you can be part of an upcoming episode after enjoying these important messages from our sponsors.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant, Sweet Tango Apples, guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples, too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
Wait a minute. I got to fix this mic.
Okay.
Perfect. There we go. Now we're good. Welcome back to American Hauntings, and thanks to all who've joined us for episode number 20 of our latest season. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the creator of American Hauntings, and I wrote and narrated this episode while hanging out in one of the rooms at the Winchester Mansion. My friend and co-host and producer and editor, Cody Beck, was with me here somewhere. He went off looking for a way to get upstairs. I haven't seen him since, so I hope he's not lost. I guess we'll see. Oh, wait, shit, there he is. Cody back.
Troy, you won't believe the shit I just went through.
All right.
I think I probably only made it 15 feet out of here before I was just...
Well, you were already lost.
I was just trying to find... Back. I was trying to find a Wi-Fi signal or like...
Well, that's probably going to be tough. So...
Yes. Oh, man. I know we got a lot of stuff to talk about with this. And this episode, I think it's been a long time coming. It's going to be... It's a thing that people ask about. And
I know they do. And it's one of those that tends to disappoint people, I think, you know, they find out that, you know, not everything is quite what everyone thought it was.
Yes.
And hey, listen, don't get me wrong. I was certainly, and I've always been one of those people who just dreamed of this being like the ultimate haunted house. And,
right.
Well, I'm not saying it's not haunted. There just seems to be a few problems with the story. So
I'm going to talk about that. And then also how this episode ended up not disappointing me as far as how it went. So we'll dive into that though. But before that, okay. We're coming towards the tail end of October, kind of almost like hell month. you might have mentioned, but you got a couple things coming up here, but then we're going to, you know, round out the end of the year.
What's up? Absolutely. October 31st is the next thing I've got open. And that is the Houdini Seance. And it is, we're down to just a handful of spots for it, but we still have some left. And I probably should have mentioned that it starts at 7 o'clock, and this is not like a, you know, oh, well, let's have a seance and go home. There's a presentation on Houdini first, before we do anything, before we get into all this, because I think a lot of people need a little background at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been almost 100 years since he died. And while everybody knows the name, they don't know a whole lot about him and why and where's in the house. So I would to do a little bit of that, which is something that I've always enjoyed. In fact, one of the very first, professional things I ever had published was a thing about Houdini and Conan Doyle and it was a weird relationship, you know, as friends that they had.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's one of those things that I've been interested in forever. And I happen to have many different copies of that radio show that was done that promoted the, you know, last official Houdini seance in 1936. I got it on records, cassettes, digital, like several different ways. I mean, so yeah, it's going to be a fun night. So if you've been thinking about coming and you don't know about seances, dude, I don't know about seances either, but it's still going to be fun. So
yeah,
we also put up all of our dinner and spirits events for the rest of the winter and the spring. We've got not only the dinner tours, but we've got, you know, St. Louis Exorcism and the American Witch and H.H. Holmes and the Limp Family and Gangsters and Lincoln and Cults and Sideshows and all kinds of stuff. And one of the big things we just started promoting was the November 30th release of my new book, Devil's Carnival. Remember, someone called our podcast that like 5 years ago. You remember that?
Yes.
And
yes.
I said, I'm going to use that as a book title. And sure enough, I have. So
you did.
That is going to be coming out November 30th. It has nothing to do with the podcast, but it's going to be fun anyway. But yeah, anyway, and also one last thing, American Oddities Museum will be open on Halloween Day during the day. And of course, that Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, like we always are. So still a couple of weekends left to come see us there at the museum, you know, Halloween season, come see us. I mean, we're going to be open anyway, but this coming weekend, my son Oren will be there with his art. And so that'll be our pop-up for the weekend, and it's going to be a good time. So we hope to see you guys around next couple of weeks.
Yeah, he's been tagging people and stuff that follow his page, and he's just keep on just doing his crazy stuff, man. It's really cool.
I know.
I still have my little check underneath your bed one hanging up in the apartment. That's awesome. And yeah, and Troy, I was debating, you know, I always for those of you who don't come to any of the events, I always do this. For those of you that do come to the events, just shut up. I always, you know, dress up in character for whatever you're doing. I wanted to dress up as Houdini, but Troy, I was just worried somebody was just going to punch me in the stomach.
Well, either that or, you know, you could come as one of his sideshow or one of his attraction things in a straight jacket, but we might leave you in it. I know. I don't know.
In the Mineral Springs. So, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I'm going to, what's the thing from Now You See Me? It's I'm going to pull a hat out of a rabbit or whatever. change it up. Gosh. Okay. Well, hey, before we dive in, I have a listener review to go into. And this is from somebody titled Avid Podcast Listener, or Avid Pod Listener, rather. And this says, it's titled Great Show. It says, as a lifelong talk radio and audio story listener, this podcast has the quote unquote goods. Starts with the host and the voice and the cadence, etc., etc. Not underproduced and not overproduced, but right where it needs to be. Love the pace, topics, and overall storytelling. Worth the 5 stars and worth your time. I took that as a huge win as far as like, I try to produce it as well as I can. And maybe it's just like, I'm hitting the sweet spot. I know sometimes things get a little crazy, but that still meant a lot. And so, yeah, I just wanted to say thank you for that. And I apologize. I skipped ahead a little bit here because I also wanted to give a quick shout out to our Patreon subscribers. So thank you very much for subscribing to our Patreon show, to Jennifer, Elizabeth, Natalie, and Andrew. Troy, where are you with that? I know something else is coming up, but are we wrapped up pretty quick?
Yeah, we are just about to wrap up season three, or the fourth season, rather. We have 3 full seasons already up, and we have 1 episode left in our Ed Gein Texas Chainsaw crossover season. So one more, that'll be coming next week. And then we'll be starting off after probably... probably after the holidays is normally how I do it. We'll be starting up with our next season, and we'll be promoting that and things as it starts to get a little bit closer. So yeah, we actually do those shows every other week. So it kind of goes in between our regular podcasts. So you, that way they get, if you're a Patreon supporter, a new show every single week. So I think that most of the people that do it have been with us for a long time. And so I think they would recommend it. I hope. So anyway, if you want to check it out, go to patreon.com / American Hauntings, and you can get signed up for as little as $5 a month. So
$5 a month.
I know. Hard to go wrong.
Awesome. Well, okay. When we dive into this episode, as many people know, a lot of times I go through Troy's written outline before I get to edit the audio part. So how my outline started here, Troy, it was, it was Winchester Mansion, just giving some facts. Uh-huh. Then it was the truth. Uh-huh. Then it jumped up to, I had to go back and say the quote unquote truth. Then I had my second section was the problems with the truth. And then my third section was finally the real truth. So yeah, you were bouncing me all around here.
Well, there was no easy way to cover this one. I mean, I could have done like I did with the Congaleer Mansion in Pittsburgh and just kind of break it down a section at a time. But there's just no way to do that because, you know, the legend of the house is one that so many people know. I mean, I've seen it in, you know, magazines and comic books and things. And it's, you know, there's no one to blame for this. It isn't like, you know, like was at least one other location that we followed that they knew that it wasn't true, but kept saying it anyway. This was just one of those things where everybody just sort of took it for granted.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we just thought, oh, well, this is the story. This is what's always been told. Well, it turns out that what we've always been told was mostly the work of, you know, a sideshow guy from literally from the carnival, who came in and wrote his own version of the story.
The other greatest
selling
showman.
It right as an attraction, you know, and so nobody knew the difference. I mean, I've seen some pretty official looking publications that have told the story that, you know, she was on the run from ghosts who were haunting her, you know, and it turns out that, yeah, that really wasn't the case, you know.
Yeah.
You know, when a lot of the things we thought we knew about her, you know, they make a great story, and it was even a fun movie. I don't know if you saw the movie.
I did. Oh,
Helen Mirren.
Yes.
It was a lot of fun. It's a great movie, but it's about as realistic as the Conjuring films, as it turns out. Those are, you know, really based
that's
on
a little
kind
more
of reality.
That's
either,
a little more malicious.
Are a little more malicious. This was just a story that became a story. I mean, it just became a legend that we all accepted because it's a cool story.
I think of all the kind of things we go through and where it's just a story. Like, this is probably like the one of the best, like, stories, you know, like just all the fictitious stuff or whatever. It's so good, and it's so entertaining, and it's so just like, holy shit, you have my attention,
quick. And, you know, and the other thing, even when you find out, you know, the reality behind the story, it's not disappointing.
I'm not
because
disappointed
the,
at all.
The real story's really good too. And
exactly.
I guess what I like about it so much is that I look at it and I don't see it as like a huge crime, other than the fact that we have underestimated this woman for over a century now, because we've been thinking that, you know, she, you know, was a kind of a loon that thought these ghosts were after her and built this house. Instead, she was some kind of genius who probably with the right schooling and education could have been a really good architect, you know. And as it was, she was just kind of coming up with her own thing and still turning it into something. So she just was someone who was underestimated and not really given her due as a woman at the time. I mean, this was, as I mentioned in the story, is that, you know, she started building and designing a house when the term woman architect didn't exist. There just weren't any, you know. I always think about the guy who invented the Brooklyn Bridge, or designed the Brooklyn Bridge, who became very, very sick. And his wife ended up finishing it and doing any changes or anything to be made. And she couldn't tell anybody that it was her that was doing it, because nobody would take her seriously.
They'd be like, oh, it's going to fall over.
Yeah, right. It was a woman, so they wouldn't take it seriously. And so she kept having to say that it was her husband who was doing all these things.
Wow.
And it was, you know, and this is the same kind of thing. You know, nobody would have taken it seriously if they had known that it was, you know, that it was Sarah who was doing all this. And not only that, but nobody liked her anyway. The locals didn't, because she had become like this, you know, target for them. You know,
it's so terrible. It's like people would accept, oh, she's getting these designs from spirits and passing them on. But if she's just coming up with it and doing some of it herself, no.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned the Brooklyn Bridge thing too, because Facebook memories popped up yesterday, and it was, 12, 14 years ago, yesterday was my first time on the Brooklyn Bridge, and we have pictures of that. And I was showing somebody, and I was like, wow. But yeah, you mentioned we're used to seeing Sarah Winchester as an eccentric woman who believed she was haunted by ghosts, but not as an architectural pioneer, but she was. And yeah, because she was amazing. Like,
yeah, I mean, she was just playing around with this because she could. I mean, she had all this money and nothing to spend it on, really. And so she could just keep doing whatever she wanted to do with this house.
Yeah.
You know, and then all it took was, you know, one person. I mean, it took a lot of rumors and things for one
thing.
And notice that, you know, when I talked about those newspaper articles that appeared, none of them said anything about, well, they didn't really say anything about ghosts. They just kept saying that she was crazy and believed she was going to die if she stopped building.
Right.
So there's a difference. The ghost part came in later when, you know, when the showman took over the house and started leasing it and, you know, cooking up his own, you know, adventures. As someone who just finished writing a book about carnivals and sideshows, Yeah, you can't believe anything that got printed on the show cards of all the, you know, the performers and things, because they just made up anything right. they wanted to. Yeah, I have giant feet because my mother was scared by an elephant when
yeah.
I was when she was pregnant with me, and I came out with these feet. I don't know what to do about it, but show them off, you know, that kind of thing. And that's exactly what happened with this house.
I even think about, you know, one of my favorite movies of all time is The Greatest Showman, not for historical accuracy.
Oh, no, exactly. I love it, too. It's a great movie.
And one of the things where he's like 300 pounds, 500.
Yeah, like, you know, exactly. Exactly. Kind of, you know, I always talk, when I do talk about like P.T. Barnum, I'll always say, if it sounds familiar, it's because Hugh Jackman played a much better looking version of it. Yes. But listen, the things you saw in the movie, that's not even scratching the surface of the stuff he came up with.
Right. Know? Yeah.
Well, let me introduce you to the Fiji mermaid, you know. So
yeah, we didn't sew anything together. Yeah. And it's when talking about, you know, the fact that she was able to construct these, or, you know, come up with these designs and build some of these things. I built a table out of a pallet once because I wanted to see if I could do it. I broke my thumb within 10 minutes. Not even kidding. And like, so this is just like, it's impressive.
Well, I mean, the good thing is she wasn't actually doing the construction. I mean, she had people to do that, still had to design it. And, you know, that's not an easy job. I mean, it's, you know.
So is there truth to the part that this, there's a couple of things where I wasn't sure where the line was drawn, but did it actually inspire the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland, or is that?
Yes. Yes. That is true. That part is true. And it's also true that it inspired Rose Red.
And I knew that.
Yeah. That Stephen King's,
gotcha.
That he turned into the miniseries, which I told you my Rose Red story, right? Some reason I had gotten it in my head that I really wanted to watch this movie again. This is like, I don't know, maybe like a year and a half or so ago. And I really wanted to see it. Well, it wasn't available anywhere streaming. And so I started looking for, every time I'd go to an antique mall or something, I had Sam looking for stuff. And we would always be looking for Rose Red. And eventually, I found VHS tapes. Well, I did not have a VHS player, so I got one from eBay. I got a CD or a DVD and VCR VHS, combo thing, you know. And so I got that. And then I found a British copy, which was okay because I've got an all regions DVD player.
Uh-huh.
And then I finally found an actual DVD, no Blu-rays, DVD of it. And I thought, finally, I'm going to watch it. And the next week, Hulu put it on streaming.
Damn. probably knew.
You gotta be kidding me. I was on this quest for like a year and I finally found copies for me to watch. And then I watched it and I was like, oh,
you know what? Yeah, I'm gonna assume
it's not really that great.
I'm going to assume that you mentioned it on the podcast and that caused such a surge.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
That
I'm
Hulu
sure that was it. Yeah,
you know, uh-huh. I knew some people back in Hulu.
Yeah, it's not great.
Sure,
I mean,
it's
okay, but it's even Stephen King has a cameo as a pizza delivery guy. That's like the best.
Oh, that's
but
that's,
I mean, there's good people in it, and it's not terrible. It's just not great.
Not one of his best. When I was reading through the original earlier kind of, you know, superstitious story and all that stuff, my first thought was, okay, she meets with this foreman every day and just flips the script. I was like, who's this foreman and how is he not just like, holy shit, lady? Or is he like, I'm getting paid?
Well, but see, that's how a lot of stories got started. The rumors got started about her, though.
Yeah.
These guys that go home and go, yeah, she shows up with these papers every day.
Right.
And I don't know what's going on. There's crazy stuff happening here. And that's when, you know, people started to talk. And, you know, eventually it made its way into the newspapers that she's a lunatic who thinks she's going to die if her house stops building. I mean, she wasn't building around the clock, no 24
right.
hours a day, 7 days a week, any of that kind of stuff. But, you know, it was enough that the newspapers thought that they could do something fun.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
You know, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So
I think something too with the story, the, you know, the story, quote unquote, that I never really thought about was I never considered the part about demolishing things that were already built.
Right, right. Well, you just tear them back down, start over again.
Yeah,
I mean, she even said it in
expansion.
That. Right. She even said it in that letter. She goes, I put in this hallway and it was too dark. So we ended up tearing out the wall and, you know, putting in a skylight, you know, kind of thing. And so there was a lot of that too. But I mean, this house is massive. Don't get me wrong. It's gigantic. And it's, you know, it'd be one of those things that if you were a tour guide there, you really have to learn your route. There'd have to be some secret, you know, notes here to get you through this thing. Because it's quite a place. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, I have a 1200 square foot apartment. Sometimes I walk down and I'm trying to go to the bathroom. I turn the wrong way. It's left or right. And sometimes I'll turn. I can't imagine walking.
Me either.
So you said the family's real fortune was still in shirts. I never had to really think about that.
Yeah. Shirts. And it was for a while, mostly because the repeating rifle didn't take off the way they thought it was to at first, because they were convinced, Oliver was convinced that the U.S. Army was going to want these. And honestly, they should have.
You get a military contract.
The war would have ended much sooner if people had just adopted the repeating rifle rather than, you know, one shot that you've got to stop and reload like we did during the revolution. You know, I mean, even the fastest guys, I mean, it was, you could do it in like, I don't know. You watch Last of the Mohicans, you know, that's speeding up because it takes longer than that. Well, there's like 10 steps, you know.
The fastest guys too, you might have a shot that does not go where you were trying to aim it.
Well, there's that. Yeah. You don't want to get in too big of a hurry. Plus, you know, depending on what kind of bullets you're shooting, they don't go the right way. And I mean, it was all kinds of stuff. And so, you know, it probably would have ended faster, but they didn't take off. In fact, most of his initial contracts came from foreign countries. Because back then it wasn't, you know, it didn't matter who it was. And we weren't, you know, it wasn't like we were at war with other people. I mean, we'd been at war with Britain. Mm-hmm. That was pretty much it, you know, as far as foreign countries go. Well, although I guess Stephen Decatur had been over in, you know, North Africa and stuff. But for the most part, the Barbary Wars and then with the Mexican War, I guess. But still not a big deal. It's not like they were selling weapons to Iran or somewhere.
Well, you know, it's like, I think a Lord of War where he's pretty much talking about, he's like, I was selling guns to both sides of the
war. Yeah, exactly. You know, and which was fairly common. But so anyway, he's selling guns to foreign countries. And finally, people start buying them and using them. And it did become, well, every Western you've ever seen, when you see someone with a rifle, it's probably a Winchester repeating rifle. Absolutely. If he fires it more than once. So it really was the gun that won the West. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which would, of course, then, you know, become a thing where who knew? And I honestly didn't know that we were that deep in our feelings of guilt in the 1920s and 30s about westward expansion. I mean, that seems like something that people worry about like today.
Yeah.
About guns. It doesn't I just didn't run through my head. Maybe, although maybe after World War One with all that death and things, maybe people were feeling funky about it. Maybe. I don't know. But, you know, I guess that was part of it, that, you know, this was a guy, he was writing a script and, well, we should feel bad about all the guns because, you know, we didn't do it, but all the guns did, the damn guns, you know. Guns. You know, guns don't kill people. No, was it? No,
people don't kill people.
They say guns don't kill people. People do, but it was kind of reversed at the time, I guess.
When you're
thinking about the westward expansion and, you know, I guess, again, kind of hard to at that point when you're 30 years away from, or what, 40 years away from the gunfight at the OK Corral.
Yeah.
People were still glorifying everything about the old West, just like we do now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we still do. And we don't, as long as you don't think about it too hard and mm-hmm. think about all the land that was taken away and, you know, all that, people still get excited about their Westerns.
Yes, we do. And you talked about as far as the gossip about her and everything. He said defenders were few and far between. 2 years later, an article appeared in the San Jose Evening News titled "Only Gossip, No Truth in the Story of the Winchester Palace." And this is something I want to bring up, is that you know, with this, maybe it wasn't terrible, but it's almost like if you bring up some bullshit or you post some bullshit, and it doesn't matter if there's a retraction or not, like the damage is done.
Too late. Yeah, it was too late by then. And really all they were doing was trying to, I mean, you know, it you got the gist of it. And I mentioned that too, is that, you know, it just sounded like they were really just promoting this Clara Valley,
right.
You know, hey, knock this shit off because we're going to lose money. If you want jobs, you got to be quiet or nobody's going to want to come here if you're going to dog on rich people, you know.
This goes for everybody, even today, even myself. Just maybe think two steps ahead if you're about to say something. Think a little bit further down the line.
I'll start to post things sometimes like on Facebook or something. And then I think I stop and read it first, and yes. then I go, no, don't post that.
I've done the same thing. And Troy, you and I have even talked about posting things or doing this and that, and we'll kind of message each other, and be like, hey,
should we do this or yeah?
And then we're like, most of the time the answer is no, don't do that. I'm glad we got to talk about this. It's like writing angry letters but not sending them, sort of thing.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
more people could learn from that, I think. So.
Right.
I know I can sometimes. So.
And speaking of events coming up, everything. So eventually Houdini gets to go through the house once it's kind of more.
Which is a wild result from his thing. I still can't believe he didn't say something. This woman spent all this money because of fake spirit medium told her to, which wasn't true, but that's how it was promoted at the time. And he didn't say a word about it. All he said was, what a neat house.
I was trying to think if maybe I was misunderstanding what he was going for. Cause I was wondering if maybe he was just saying like, hey, this is just a cool, like feat that somebody.
Yeah. I mean, he just said, you know, what an amazing house. He didn't talk about, he told the reporters, here's the story and wow, what a neat house it turned out to be. And, you know, maybe his implication didn't come through in the written report, or maybe somebody, I find it hard to believe that at that point in his career, he wouldn't have said, you know, this poor woman got taken advantage of. That hard to believe, but he didn't, unless it got left out, which is very possible. It was 1920s. So,
In 9 days, we'll ask him. Say, hey, Harry.
Yeah, okay.
Harry, what's going on? What happened with this? And then it's featured. Ripley features it in their written publication.
Sure.
This is one of the things where it's such an amazing story because, again, she was such an awesome architect. And then this is just such a great example of something taking on a life of its own because
absolutely. A bunch of different factors. Oh, God, this is a perfect example of that. Yeah.
Yeah,
and we'll have another one before this season is over.
Nice.
It definitely took on a life of its own. And I couldn't even begin to tell you how many times I have read this story over the years in various books and magazines and everything else. Just the general story of here's a woman who built a house because, you know, she built it for ghosts or was designed by or inspired by ghosts. And it's cool and it's a great story, but it's, you know, not really true.
Right.
But is it haunted? That I'm not saying it's not. There's an awful lot of stories here, but I'm struggling to figure out why it would be haunted. Unless, traveling ghosts who just wanted a nice place to stay.
Why not?
You know, maybe some workmen or who knows? I don't know. I have no idea.
I like the quote you said, or has our deep belief in fabricated stories of the Winchester Mansion somehow created a haunting? And because something, you know, as far as things we cannot prove, there's ghosts. And then, but I think I put ghosts slightly lower for myself as far as humans and people just pushing things into existence, you know, willing things into existence.
Sure.
Like, why not?
We've talked about that we've talked about that before. You and I have talked about it personally, and I've talked about it with lots of people. I mean, there are plenty of instances where I really think people have, you know, willed a haunting into taking place. You know, I mean, whether it's through, you know, I'm not saying they conjured a real ghost. I'm saying that things happen because they truly believe that they are happening. And you know, either imagine them into stories or somehow create something. I mean, there's a reason why, and I even mentioned Tulpa like ghost story. We've talked about Tulpas before. And you know, people who created ghosts, and there's a reason that's part of an ancient, you know, faith, you know, that it was believed to be done by, you know, like the oh gosh, my mind just drew a blank. It's, you know, Nepal, the guy up on the top of the mountain,
Tibetan,
the Tibetan, whatever that boot, Are they Buddhists?
Buddhists?
Is that what the guy is? What's his name? The Dalai Lama.
Oh, gosh.
God. Yeah, my mind just not getting this.
It's all right.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a reason that that's part of their faith. And then I do know that in the early or late 1800s, when theosophy came into popularity, that thing that was, it was kind of a Buddha-like or Buddhist-like faith that started by Madame Blavatsky, Helena Blavatsky.
Yeah.
And theosophy became this thing. Part of their teaching was creating tulpas, but not the same as what the ancient people did. It was more of literally creating a ghost by thinking about it. And, you know, there's that story about the people in Canada that created that ghost, Philip. The Philip experiment. I think we talked about that one time.
I don't remember so much.
We probably will at some point. We'll talk more about it. But
okay.
they literally created a ghost, and they imagined what it looked like. It things happened. They literally physically documented by scientific experiment happened after they created this thing. So maybe millions of people believing in the Winchester Mansion, you know, and visiting this place over the years, maybe we just
could be
brought the place to life. Or is it the house itself? You know, like the Overlook Hotel in The Shining.
Yes. No. Yeah. I mean, a huge place with so much energy put into it.
There you go.
As a conduit.
Sure.
Sort of,
why not?
I mean, it makes as much sense as anything else. Like,
yeah,
you know, like
that's probably true.
Why not?
Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, you know, there are an awful lot of things that are reported, and it's hard to imagine over, you know, 100 years that all of these people are just wildly imaginative,
sure,
making it up. I mean, let's just say some could be.
How do you get 10%
of the loons? You know,
10% of them, even, is probably a good number, you know.
Like, that's true, because there's been enough reports that, yeah, even if a small fraction of them were legitimate,
right?
It's still a haunting. So, and I know that this is technically not a murder house, but the story behind it is all these people were murdered with the guns,
right,
and it's what we believed was the reason why the house was haunted. So that's how my loophole.
Troy, we can look at it from the other angle and say this is the story that has the most murders ever.
Well, that's true. Good point. Yeah, that's true too. It's just none of them actually happened on the property. So technically, it's a little outside of what we said it was going to be for the season, but
yeah.
Like I said, I mean, that's my loophole, and
yeah.
I ducked through it, and I'm going to keep it. So.
But you
and it's our podcast, so we can do whatever.
Yeah, and you freaks know that you wanted a show about the Winchester.
Yeah,
house.
So like, there, you know, yeah, you wanted an episode. No other way to get it in there, so there it is. So
awesome. Well, Troy, it is now time for our Ghostwriter segment. So if you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. And this message comes to us from Luke, and it's titled Banjo. Luke writes, "Hey, I just found your podcast that was sorting through many purported paranormal podcasts that just didn't cut it. Eventually, I found yours and listened to the Vermont episode because I live in Vermont and also hiked to the long trail over Glastonbury Mountain. I absolutely love it, but I'm a banjo player, and I'm so happy to hear the banjo accenting the story. So my question is, who's playing the banjo for you? I'm so stoked on your storytelling and the fact that you have banjo music playing behind it at all." So for people that don't know what Luke's talking about, this is from season 6, our Woods and Fields, Dark and Wicked season. And all the music in that season was performed by our friend Packy Lundholm. And he, you can find him on Twitter, Instagram, Bandcamp, SoundCloud, Facebook, YouTube, and PackyLundholm.com. It's LundHolm.com. Packy, whom I have never met. I've talked to him before. Don't know if he actually exists, but he did all the music.
He does.
Is what Troy says.
Yeah, he does.
He exists. But that was our buddy Pack.
Yeah. But yeah, he did all the music for that season. We wanted something that was kind of folk music-ish,
right,
you know, or, you know, Dust Bowl-ish kind of thing. So
yeah, he said give me 5 minutes.
Yeah, he did a great job.
Stuff.
Yeah, it did take him like 5 minutes to put that together, and
he did some really cool stuff.
He did, yeah, he did. So
thanks for writing in. Check out all his stuff if you're interested in that music. Troy, do you have some hotline stuff?
We sure do. So if you guys have that comment about the show or quick question, as I said, you can email Cody or you can text us on the Haunt line, which is 217-791-7859. And it might get read on the show. We still have some that we're saving for our movie season. We're not movie season,
good grief.
Our movie episode next week, our Halloween episode. And I'm trying to look at these because I don't want to read any of them out of order here because I'm saving them. But here's one from Kirk in the 336. And it says, howdy, Troy and Cody, been loving the new season. Oh, this is the one about if you had to live in one of the homes. In the season. So we did have someone who had written in. I don't think you and I had a choice on. I don't think we picked anything on that.
Yeah.
I mean, the Winchester Mansion might be fun.
That could be fun.
I'd be super lost the entire time. And really, none of the rest of them are any place I don't think I'd want to live. You know, maybe the Los Feliz murder house. It's kind of cool, but it really need to be fixed up. Well, I guess somebody did fix it up. They never finished it. But I don't know. Maybe I don't know if I've got one of those or not.
So. I'm just going to go to the Bellwitch Cave and just become something completely different
and just live in the cave.
How long I last.
This one comes from Aaron in the 217. This is Aaron. Just wanted to say thanks. I bugged you a couple of times about doing some stories on Decatur since that's where I'm from, and remember I said absolutely no.
Yes
or not. No, I think he asked me about doing a season on Decatur and I said something about I'd rather have things shoved under my fingernails, but he was happy that we did a new episode, or our last episode did take place in Decatur. So that was my, you know,
that's all you get.
My bit of a give to Aaron there on and putting in
an Aaron, you're done. That's all you house. Get.
Yeah, that's all you get. So
I don't know, maybe
it goes. So all right. So this one is from the 501 and it just says, wanted to say I'm a huge fan of y'all's. So I'm gonna guess the 501 is somewhere down south. I did have a question. Would y'all say again, ever do a season on the Appalachian Trail and some of the things that happened there? I just started watching TikToks of it. Wasn't sure if anything would be covered in a future season. Y'all are amazing. Stay spooky. I don't know about that. I'm not going to say no, but I feel like that if we did it, we would have to go out and like hike the trail, and I'll never get Cody to do that. So,
wow.
Yeah. Huh?
We can
why?
Talk
about- you said why?
Yeah. I'm an Eagle Scout. I don't know.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. But yeah, so I don't know about that one. It might end up in something. I mean, we did that Woods and Fields Dark and Wicked, but you know, I don't think we're planning on stopping anytime soon. So we're going to have a lot of seasons ahead. So you just never know. So, all right. So here's our last one. This is from Cameron in the 480. It says, hey, Troy and Cody, longtime listener here, reaching out for the first time. So I think that's supposed to be longtime listener, first time texter.
Like, yes. But
anyway, first want to express my condolences to Cody on his recent losses. Hope you're doing okay.
Thank you.
My friends and I meet once a month to play a tabletop RPG together, usually Dungeons and Dragons. This summer, we started a Ghostbusters RPG set in New Orleans, based partly on the podcast. And a fictionalized version of Troy has become a character in the campaign. He's a local bookstore owner with a wide knowledge of the area's history, especially when it comes to true crimes and hauntings. I thought you guys would get a kick out of that idea. That's fun.
That's my gosh. Cool, okay. I don't, people don't know this. I play tabletop every Thursday night.
Oh, do you really? Oh, okay.
I do. I didn't know that. I just got a 3D printed little staircase dice roller. Long story short, my stepdad sold his truck the other day. I had to go help him figure it out, and I go into this man's house that's selling the truck, and there are just tabletop games everywhere. And I was like, so you like your tabletops, eh? And I'm talking to this guy, and I look at this little staircase dice roller thing. It's like a spiral thing, and you just toss your die in and it just rolls down. And he's like, yeah, I 3D printed some. This one was kind of the first model, so it's not perfect. Like, do you want it? And I was like, absolutely, I want it. I took it. But also, that's amazing. If anybody wants to create a character for me that's like, I don't know, his sniveling assistant or something crazy in your game, That's so awesome. Yeah.
The Scooby Dude, my Shaggy. So,
oh, yeah.
All right. So finish this up. It says, love the work you guys do. I'm always excited when a new episode shows up in the feed. Thanks for getting me through my work days. And don't worry, it's an office job, so no lives are in danger. Because that's always our concern, is that someone's going to like lose an arm.
Yeah.
Or something, because
they're using a forklift or something.
Yeah. So, oh, and speaking of your dad selling a truck, if anybody's interested in buying a hearse, get in touch with me. I have a 1993 Cadillac hearse currently for sale. Wow. If you're interested, please get in touch, because it could be yours. Anyway, so if you guys have any other questions, comments, whatever. Also, we're still looking for comments from you guys for if you've got what you think the difference is between a suspense film and a horror film and how they get rated that way. Let us know. Just send it over to the hotline. It's 217-791-7859. That's one of the things we're going to talk about in our movie episode. We're also going to be talking about, just to kind of give you a bit of a spoiler, some adaptations of films that have been done, mostly Stephen King things. This is inspired by the recent Salem's Lot remake that appeared on Max. We're going to be comparing a little bit from the original Salem's Lot miniseries to the 2006 miniseries and how it holds up and how they hold up next to this new one. And we're also going to talk about It and the differences, the comparisons between the two, and Pet Sematary as well. So that's kind of be a little bit of what we're going to discuss. I'm sure there'll be some other things too. I was just at the movies yesterday to see a sequel, which, I mean, often you guys know how I feel about sequels and, you know, prequels and things like that. But, you know, overall, it was a decent experience.
Yeah.
So we won't talk about our top 10 list or anything, but we'll probably get into some of the stuff we've aided. Because I have some of those.
Me too.
You know, and I don't really like to color our year end episode of good movies with all the crap that I sat through. So I usually end up railing about something on the
Halloween show.
So that'll be coming next week. So that is, so if you guys got anything you want to jump in on, between now and then, definitely let us know. I guess I'll just kind of start wrapping things up unless you've got anything else.
No, it was kind of just one of the things I want people to kind of think about more as far as the, you know, thriller and horror and suspense and things like that is, I was talking to somebody the other day, we were talking about the movie Speed. And I was like, you know, suspense, thriller, people die, not a horror film.
But
why? It's like terrible, scare, but it's clearly just not.
I don't know why. And, you know, I always think that, too. I just watched something. I forget what it was. And I thought it was going to be a horror film. And I'm like, no, this really wasn't. It was good. But it didn't have, I don't know, it just didn't feel like horror, even though it seemed like it was going to. And I saw it like listed on horror pages, you know, like Bloody Disgusting,
right,
and
right.
Horror and stuff. And they promote this stuff.
Of course,
and I watch it. And I'm like, this isn't a horror movie. That last, there was one I really liked it. And it was like the last exit of somewhere I don't know. Something it was about a diner, and it was like it kept getting promoted as a horror film, but it took place in a diner, and there's killers in there on the run from a bank robbery and all the stuff that happens because of it. And I'm like, this is not a horror film. Yes, it's suspenseful, and I don't know why, you know, horror sites are promoting this, but they are. So I don't know. I guess we got to figure out if we can, or see if we can figure out what it is for us that is the difference.
Is it something about where the fear comes from or the intention?
Maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Why is a serial killer movie a horror film? One is a horror film and another one isn't.
Right.
I think a lot of it has to do with the atmosphere of it and how it.
Yeah.
I don't know. We got to see what we can figure out, at least for ourselves, if nothing else.
Oh, yeah. We're going to get really annoying and on a lot of people's nerves with this and unnecessarily detailed. But you know what? Troy and I need this to sleep at night.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, it does bother us.
So you'll have to deal with it. Yeah. That's it. That's all I got.
All right, man. Well, thanks to everybody who's listening and sharing the show with their friends and neighbors and anybody they know. You can, if you like the show, share it with your friends. If you don't like it, share it with your enemies. Mm-hmm. And then they can be suffering. So, yes. Anyway, you can leave us a review. You can send us an email. You can drop us a text. You can also find us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, which we refuse to call X. And don't forget to use that discount code of podcast when you're shopping for books or tours or events or anything else at AmericanHauntings.net, where you'll also find the link for Cody's shirt store, AmericanHauntingsClothing.com. And you can use the same code there too, which is just the word podcast, and you'll get 10% off everything you order.
Beautiful. Well, this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and performed by Troy Taylor, and it was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, which features show notes, links, and that's it to go along with each episode.
Yeah, exactly.
thanks again. We couldn't and definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See y'all.
See you later.
All right.
I'll say y'all. See y'all
later. I know. See,
that's stay in the theme of the text.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Mmm, boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? Mmm, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.